Well, welcome to the Oxford Centre for Tropical Forests. A few new faces perhaps here. We have talks almost every Friday in term time on various aspects of tropical forests, from natural sciences to social sciences and governance and policy. Lots of external speakers, but we've made a conscious decision to have one or two internal to Oxford speakers every term. So if any of you have ideas for people both externally that would like to come, or just would like to give a talk yourself or recommend some of your colleagues, get in touch. And as a first of this, we have Ema Oliveras. It seems strange to be introducing.
Yes, it's that kind of
but, Ema did her undergraduate and PhD in Barcelona, working on fire and Mediterranean ecosystems. And then she did postdocs in Brazil, working in the Cerrado system and fire there. And then came to Oxford and was sent up the slopes of the Andes to look at fire on the Andean tree line. And then after a spell as a Marie Curie fellow in Wageningen in the Netherlands, working in Ghana and West Africa on fire, she's come back here and is now a departmental research lecturer and also deputy program leader of the ecosystems program. So, welcome, Ema.
Okay, thanks for your dinner. It's kind of weird and funny to be here. So, this is quite a broad title, but the reason I chose this title is because I wanted to show you a little bit what I have been doing, especially since I first came to Oxford in 2009. And I think that the very common axis that defines my research is that I have always worked with vegetation transitions and fire. But fire has some relationship to climate change, so it could be in global change, and it dresses more sexy than just fire. So I choose that title for that. What I mean with tropical vegetation transitions is it's in the ecological concept of ecotones, that are areas where the species of two different communities meet in their limits. And usually these ecotones or transitions, as I mentioned them, can have an abrupt shift. Like here you see in the Peruvian tree line, you see all the grassland, an abrupt shift to the tropical montane cloud forest, or something more gradual, like here in this Brazilian Cerrado, that you have some shrubs and bare soil, and here there are grasses and a transition gradation to semi-deciduous forest. Oops. So these transitions are unique because they provide many ecosystem functions, and they are provide many landscape functions as seed dispersal and also and animals move through them. As here you can see, for instance, in the Peruvian tree line, I don't know the English name, Oso de Anteojos, a spectacled bird, eating an ericacea leaves here and happily in the transition from the puna to the grassland. And here, this is a picture from Annabelle, a forest elephant in Gabon, just at the forest-savanna transition. And these transitions are especially sensitive to changes in disturbing regimes, such as fire, and with the potential of one vegetation type expanding over the other. With that, there is a theory that these vegetation transitions and the vegetation representing them, that annex them, may represent alternative stable states. In this graph, here in this figure, for instance, you can see, this is a study by Carla Staber, you can see that everything that is graded in dark orange or in light green is what they call a bistability. So climatically, it could support either a forest or either a low canopy cover, low tree cover vegetation type. But what is determined nowadays is mostly because of the climate. And as you see, large part of South America could be bistable, and also in Africa, especially in the savanna and forest region. And also in some parts of Australia and a little bit less than us on Asia. I'm going to be deliberately neglecting and not speaking about Asia. If someone is about Asia, I apologize for that, but I don't do any work there, so I'm kind of just ignoring it. and focusing in savanna, i.e. in Africa and South Africa. So to explain a little bit more about this alternative stable states, that comes from the ecological theory that predicts that you have an initial state, and then imagine that here you have a ball, and then you're going to have a shift in given a parameter that is going to cause a shift in some vegetation parameter or in a state of that ecosystem, and it's going to one of the two shifts is going to cause your vegetation, your ball, to move forward and go to a new stable state. However, it also predicts that there will be some hysteresis. That is, that if you want to move the ball backwards, reverse the perturbation, there is not the same pathway. It's going to be more difficult. When you translate that in the context of forest-savanna transitions or vegetation transitions, this would be represented in the form of forest, savanna, and treeless or grassland vegetation. And it would be defined basically by an axis of precipitation and tree cover. However, you would have at the both ends, so at very high precipitation, you would have a high tree cover, so you would have a forested state, and at a very low precipitation rate, you would have low tree cover. However, at intermediate values of precipitation, you could have either a savanna or a low tree cover state or a precipitation. And one of the main focuses of research nowadays is what determines one vegetation type of the other. And there has been some effort also to test this thing about the hysteresis, and there is some models that support some hysteresis at the local scale, but there is little evidence at a larger scale. And empirically, there is little evidence. So for instance, here, this is a study in 2012 by Higgins and Schaefer. They predicted, they modeled changes in variables, so CO2, rainfall, temperature, and fire. And they predicted the possibility of having a C4-dominated vegetation, or C4 or C3. So C4 would be grasslands. Grasslands usually, C4 and C3, for those that don't know, is a different metabolism of vegetation. And usually, C4 corresponds to grasses, not always, but sometimes, and C3 to trees. So here you would have abrupt changes in the state when there is a gradation from one state to the other. And sometimes you have a lag between the direction of one of the movements, and this would be the hysteresis. So basically, they shown that there is kind of abrupt changes at the local scale and some hysteresis, basically mostly with temperature and fire. However, at the continental scale, there would be more of a gradual shift in directions on that. However, this is, as I will come back to this later, especially when I talk about forests and savannas, and this is very challenging to prove in empirically. So it requires manipulation, and it's very difficult to come. So I'll come back later. So what we have nowadays is that in this graph, if you see, I don't want to pay your attention at the colors, but at the transition between the colors. So the purple is more grassland-dominated vegetation, and in green would have forested to some extent, forested or high canopy cover, above 40% of canopy cover of vegetation. And as you see, most of in the edges, it also coincides with in the lower map. You have the anthropogenic pressures. This is a paper from Gepinder, and here you would have a lot of the human population density, and also fire occurrences and anthropogenic pressures over these transition areas. Yadvinder and his colleagues also in this paper, they model what would be the effect of 4 degrees warming, of a 4 degrees climate scenario warming in these transitions. And they found that a number of models would predict a contraction, so a reduction of forests, but a number of models would predict an expansion of the niche, both in Africa and both in the Amazon. So to me, this is a fascinating topic, and it's what I try to focus my research on it. So my main question in my research question would be how and why vegetation structure and dynamics change across different environmental and disturbance gradient, and what are the consequences of these changes. And I'm very interested on the concepts of hysteresis and also vegetation resilience. And in the context of this talk, especially on ecotones, I come with fire, and I'm going to be talking on what is the role of fire and the dynamics of these vegetation transitions, and also on the carbon dynamics of the vegetation near the ecotones, and in diversity and community assemblage patterns. I am also interested, and I will be seeing how well adapted are ecotones to cope with a warmer and drier climate, and can we find common axes of variation across ecotones in different geographical areas or vegetation types? That is, to what extent different ecotones are similar or different between different areas? Can we compare the forest-savanna transition of an area in Africa with what of an area in South America? And that's one of the main questions I've been addressing in the last couple of years. So I'm going to be talking about two types of vegetation transitions. One is the Andrea tree line, and this Andrea tree line, as I'm going to explain, it's not a forest savanna or forest grassland transition, because usually this is defined with C4 grasses, and this, here you have C3 grasses. But here, for instance, you can see pictures of these transitions, and they look very much the same. The thing is that here you have a mountain and high slopes, and you would have the grasses, a fire, of course, and the forest underneath the grassland. And here there's some forest savanna transition in Brazil and in Ghana and in Gabon. So Peru, I'm going to start by Peru. And as I said, well, the tree line here is thought to be mostly determined by temperatures. And the grasslands are dominated by C3 grasses, not C4 grasses. So that's why they are kind of distinctive, and I'm not including that everything in the same group. The characteristic of these tree lines and in this transition is that they are found usually above 3,000 meters of altitude, around the 5 to 8 degree thermal isocline. In some places you can find it. So they are restricted in quite relatively small geographical areas, basically in the Andes and in Ethiopia. And here you can see, in this is the only study found that is doing a global distribution of those tree lines. And it's a study by Raman Phil in Ecography in 2015. And most of the tree lines that you find, so in gray, in yellow, you would have the grasses and the forest, and you have some gradation from 1,000 meters, but you found it especially in Africa and South America, above 3,000 meters, a little bit lower in Africa. So, and why are they important? Well, first of all, they are huge biodiversity hotspots. They are, I think that a number of you have already been there, but if you haven't, guys, go there. It's stunning, and it's really a beautiful place to go and work. And lots of orchids and amazing. And they are also very important in terms of carbonate stocks, and there are many of these vegetation sit above peatlands, as I'm going to be showing. And they are also highly productive areas. So in terms of carbon stocks, for instance, here you would have that, well, in the tree line, in the forest, of course, you would have a large carbon stocks in the forest, and this is partly of the work of our group that is doing, and the grasslands would have, of course, less above ground carbon stocks. But if you look at the below ground carbon stocks, so here you have two different grasslands in the upper islands. This is near Waikecha. You have mean average values of between 150 and 300 tons per hectare of carbon. So we are talking here about really peatlands and high organic rich carbon areas. In terms of productivity, the grasslands are equally productive and as productive as a forest. So if we look at the work that that Gevinder and Cecile, they have been leading, here you have two of the forests that are in the higher altitude, so Esperanza and Huaycaicha, and you have an MPP of about 7, between 7 and 8 in the forest, and while in the grassland you have an MPP of about 7. That's a total MPP. Above ground, it would be in the forest between 5 and roughly 6, and about 6.4 in the grassland. And below ground, equally, you would have 1.7 to a little bit more than 2, and you have 2.8 on average in the grasslands. So these are highly productive ecosystems. Of course, the residence times and things vary, and they have different dynamics, but it is a highly productive ecosystem. However, what are these tree lands are also having some threats and being vulnerability, especially because there is a tendency of rising the cloud base and having every year more warmer, dry periods and increasing mean temperatures and having less cloud frequencies. Also, anthropogenic pressures are increasing, even though that these systems have been populated and have had human influence for millennia. In the last years, anthropogenic uses, especially for cattle and fire, have been increasing. So, for instance, one of the results of rising the temperatures and rising the cloud level is some colleagues are observing a migration, a tendency of some species to migrate up slope. So, in this study, you would have plots from 950 meters to above 3,000, and you have migration rates, quite high, a lot of migration rates of several species above the tree line. So there is a tendency of the species migrate upslope with climate change. However, we are not observing a movement of the tree line upwards. And why is that? We have fires, especially, and other causes, but one of the things could be fires that are increasingly penetrating in the forest. So this is a fire that I saw in I think it was 2011, 2012, and this is a Google Earth image. The fires usually start in the puna, in the grasslands, and then they propagate downward, so backslope, and so that characterizes a very slow spreading fire, but that means that it's highly residence time, so it stays in the system, it can stay in the system if the system is dry enough for a long time. And what is and it goes slowly penetrating into the forest and causing this. This is a picture of this fire a couple of months after the fire. And as you see, all these ground areas is dead trees. So one of the things that I've been doing while studying these systems is what are the fire regimes. So when I got and started working on these tree lines, nobody really didn't know what are the fire regimes in the Andes, how many fires are there, how frequency have they changed through time, and then we wanted to see also the effects over grass productivity and nutrient cycling, and the carbon dynamics, the forest carbon dynamics, how it changed in burned forests. And also, are fires stopping tree establishment in the high-altitude grasslands? So we conducted some remote sensing analysis, and we found that the fires in the area are cyclical. So you have a cyclicity of every 4 to 6 years with fire peaks, followed by years of very low fire activity. And this would be directly associated with rainfall anomalies. So in years that you would have less rain, you would have more fires, and years that it would rain more, you would have less fires. Yes. The studies, interestingly, didn't find any direct correlation with El Niño, with any of the El Niño indices. But we believe that was because it is a very high altitude ecosystem, and maybe the sensitivity of those indices, especially in remote sensing, was not sensitive enough. Then we moved to, we also did some remote sensing analysis in a smaller scale to see what are the dynamics of these fires. And we found that for a 12-year period, almost 10% of the area had burned at least once, meaning that that would be a fire return interval of 35 years. In the lowlands, some colleagues, Alenkar and Nefstad, have reported fire return intervals of 74 years. And these are colder ecosystems, so it actually should be burning less than that. So, and then we found that every year, at least 10% of the, here I'm saying burn scars, because it's actually, remote sensing is not fire, it's, we are looking at the burn scars of coral on forest. But this is also one of the things, and here I put deliberately this word of burn scars, is because we have a lot of uncertainty on the use of these products in these altitudes. So, and why is that? First, because we have a high amount of clouds, so that limits the availability of any fire products. And also because many of those fires can go, if they go into the forest, you cannot detect the signal. The signal, the way that the signal is detected by the satellites, as you may know, is by radiative power or by the black scar. And here in our study, I don't want you to pay a lot of attention, but to the whole numbers of the table, just this is the fire hotspots product, the fire burn scar, the MODIS burn scar product, and the Landsat time series analysis that we did. And this is the total number of burn scars. And as you can see, there is a tenfold difference between one and the other. So actually, there is a lot of uncertainty. In all of them, you have an increasing trend on number of fires, but there is a lot of uncertainty between products. So this is some research and some work to be done. What are the effects of fire on carbon stocks and tree dynamics? So we have found, to answer this question, we walked all over the Andes and we found different forests that were burned, and we classified all these forests with different time chronosequences. So we classified forests that had recently burned, that had burned between 0 and 5 years before sampling, middle burn between 5 and 10 years, and between 10 and 28 years. And here on your left, you can see the proportion of trees with different tree sizes. And you have that in the recently burned, you have more saplings, so small trees in the burned forest, and significantly less in the medium range. However, in the mid-burn plots, you would have significantly less trees in the burn plots of bigger between 20 and 40 centimeters DBH, and we didn't find any significant signals on that. How that translated to carbon stocks? Here in your right side, you can see that there was a significant decrease in carbon. In the number of that is not seedlings, that is saplings, and you have an increase on the standing depth and a consumption of soil, carbots, and total carbon. And this carbon is slowly recovered through time. And in the old burned forest, you only have a significant decrease. You still have less carbon in the standing life trees. Our study also revealed, however, that old burn forests would be more biodiverse than recently burned forests or unburned forests. And here I'm presenting the table. I think the numbers explain things. So this is the number of families and the number of species, recently burned forests, unburned, unburned. So we compare the burned forest with much unburned forest. Middle term burn and old burn, and as you see, 41 species. Here you have a decrease in the midterm. And an increase, also the number of species is almost double in the long term. In the grasslands, however, we didn't find any increase on the productivity. And I'm not going to explain, so don't pay attention to this bar. In this graph, there is a Bayesian experiment, and I don't have time to go into that. Happy to touch on later. But I want you to get the message is that these two bars and these two bars in mean productivity in grasslands, burned grasslands. And these two bars is productivity in unburned grasslands. and we didn't find any significant difference. Those places had burned 3 and 5 years before we sampled. So at least we can say in 3 years it had recovered productivity. So how does this answer my questions? Well, what are the fire regimes in the Andes? We have that there is an increasing evidence that there are more frequent fires and a strong association to rainfall patterns. However, we still have many uncertainties, and this is I encourage anyone that wants to work on this. I find it fascinating. What is the effect of fires on grass productivity and nutrient cycling? Well, so far we have found no effect. It would be interesting to follow a recently burned forest and do a chronosequence sequence since the moment it burns and how it recovers, because of course it has, I'm not saying it does, there is no effect, but at least it recovers at least 3 years after the fire. And in terms of carbon dynamics, there are a lot of effects in the short term, and the signs of fire can be seen in the above ground life stocks at least up to 30 years after the fire. But it looks that overall there is a lot of recovery, especially in structure and diversity in this forest. So I pose a question: are those forests near the tree line already resilient to fire? And are forests stopping tree establishment? We don't know yet. Actually, I haven't gone into that. But we have the hypothesis that yes, there is fire that has a negative effect over tree establishment. But there are other factors such as frost or perhaps tree grass competition that may be affecting and impeding the establishment of trees going into the forest. So I'm going to go to the second part now of my talk. So we are going to leave Peru and we are going to move to Brazil and Africa and Ghana. Actually, I'm not going to talk. I'm showing a very cool picture here from Gabon, and I'm showing a couple of pictures from Gabon, but I'm not going to talk about Gabon. I'm going to leave that for later, or maybe Annabel, who is leading the work there, can one day talk about it. So, as I said, well, these transitions in the area, so this is a picture from Gabon, so it's really cool system. So, and it's a zone of tension driven by an interplay of biotic and abiotic factors. And when you try to define these transitions in the context of forest-savanna transitions, between us, it's a big mess. So because you have a huge amount of different vegetation types, and when you want to come with a global classification, it is literally an island. So usually you can come with a classification if you have take into account the height of vegetation and then the degree of grass cover and plant cover. And at one end, you would have the grasslands and the grasslands with a high kind of grass cover and low kind of cover, and at the other end, the forest. And in between, you would have the shrub savannas, the cerrados, and the woodland savannas in Africa. And usually, these ecosystems, the grassy grasslands and savannas, are half C4 grasses, usually dominated by the genera Poaceae, and then sedges that are Cyperaceae families. Families, sorry, not general. And some more cool pictures of different savanna grasslands. So this is a dry season in Brazil, but as you can see, it looks quite similar to a forest savanna transition in Ghana and so on. And one of the, going back to this thing I was talking about, the alternative stable states, there is the Morse ecological theory is posing that the forest savanna transitions and this instability of the presence of one vegetation type of the other, it is regulated by fire. And by fire through two different thresholds. One would be the fire resistance threshold, which is illustrated here, that in which you would have your grasslands with some scattered saplings or short trees, and it would grow. But then if the fire comes, if the fire comes through its field through the grasslands, the fire will kill the tree above ground, and the tree, these trees and this woody vegetation, would have storage organs and it would resprout. And then after 1-2 years, the fire would come again and it would kill it again. And it's a repeated process that it's called top kill, and the trees are able to do. And that would maintain the system really relatively treeless until you have a long interval without fire. And you have a state that the tree has grown above the height of the grasses, and when it comes, it's not able to kill the stem anymore. And on the other hand, you would have a fire suppression threshold that works more at the community level. So you have this state, and you have all these small trees and seeds and that thinking, but eventually some trees are growing. But if you have a long interval with the fire, what is going to happen is that the canopies are going to close and are going to suppress the grasses that are basically there can live because they are light demanding. And then that is going to feed back and suppress fire. And some studies also have gone into the threshold theory. So here, Vinicius Dantas showed in a cool study in the Emmaus National Park that this is CCI's canopy cover index. So savanna states would be very different from forest states in different traits. So in ratio of height to the diameter, in bark thickness, in leaf area, and in wood density. And it was finding some thresholds. This study was trying to relate that to different fire frequencies. So saying that this type of the savanna systems would have a high fire frequency and the forest system would have a low fire frequency. However, in my opinion, what they have failed and today, the big challenge is to establish the causative relation on that they show, okay, this system is low in fire and this other system is low in fire. But it is you cannot establish the causation of that relationship yet in for that. And well, and the truth is that different processes and drivers drive these transitions, and they span at different scales in terms of time and space. So at the larger space, you have evolution, and what we see today is a picture of yesterday, as I like to say, and evolution shapes to great extent what we see today in terms of vegetation. Then you have our climate, our geology, or our soil processes that shape the biomes and how they are distributed within the world. And then we have small processes like fire, fire behavior, and water regimes, and fauna that are going to determine you the drivers and at the local and limited geographical scales. So here my questions of interest is what are the ecological processes associated especially with drought and fire that led to shifts in the ecological states of forest and savanna communities? And in the test of that would be how and why seedlings and trees survive, and what are the patterns of tree death, and what are the functional relationships and tree distributions along these transitions, and then how are these relationships? Can we compare them among them or not? And when I started making these questions, we designed, and that was my Marie Curie project, we chose two different continents and two different forest savanna transitions, one in Brazil and one in Ghana. And there we went and sampled a big number of traits. We merged this with a gen traits sampling protocol. So we followed gen traits and we selected the species that would contribute to 80% of the basal area. We selected three individuals and we selected a number of branches in which we measured a whole set of functional traits. We measured the tree crown dimensions and collections that I'm going to show you some results from Ali, who's in the back there. We sampled one branch to do special leaf traits, another branch to do wood traits, and another branch to do hydraulics. And here, I hope it's okay, Ali, to show, but I think it's very cool, this result. This is a paper that it's in review that is led by Ali. He did this work, and what he's showing basically is that in Brazil you have sharp differences in the crown structure. So he took the data and he measured the crowns and analyzed the crown structure of savanna, transition, and forests. And he found that here in your left, Brazil, and in Ghana, here in Ghana. So you see that the volume, well, first of all, you have massive differences between continents. So the trees are different in Brazil and Ghana. And here in Brazil, you would have the volume, very small volumes, but they increase towards going in the forest. And also the width of the crowns would be different from a savanna than from a forest. Whereas in Ghana, you really didn't see much difference at all, also with the depth. In Brazil, in the forest, you would have the same crown depth as a savanna in Ghana. And I particularly find this result fascinating. I think it's a very cool result to see how it's the different crowns across different vegetation types. And also, and this is a world that Agnes is leading, that is also there half hidden, we look at what is the photosynthetic capacity and how it varies across different vegetations. And basically, we find no significant differences here. We find that there is a lower photosynthetic capacity in the forest, in the Brazilian forest, but overall, no differences between countries and no huge trends, a huge range of variation. The box plot reveal huge range of variation. And what she did is, well, we wondered whether that would be phylogenetically constrained and we would have some phylogenetic signal. So here you have the phylogeny of our plots, and basically in these dots, she represented the values of VC max. And the message here is there is no relationship. We didn't see any strong phylogenetic signal. In terms of leaf nutrients, however, we see some things. We don't see differences between Ghana and Brazil in terms of leaf nutrients, between nitrogen. However, we see that the nitrogen content in the forest is different than in the savanna for both Brazil and Ghana. However, the trend is reversed. Here it would be lower, and here it would be in between, but it would be lower. Sorry, no, it's the same trend. In terms of phosphorus, then you would have significant differences between Brazil and Ghana in terms of phosphorus, in terms of calcium, and in terms of magnesium. In where Brazil has higher phosphorus concentrations in the leaves, and Ghana has higher calcium and magnesium concentrations in the leaves. And then you can see that some there are usually in Ghana you have a difference in the forest with regards to the savanna, but we didn't really observe this trend. We observed it for phosphorus. The Brazilian forest had significantly higher phosphorus, but not for the cations. And when we took these nutrients and we wanted to see what these sources of variation came from. And this is a very partitioning analysis. And here, what is showing is in the y-axis is the proportion of variability of every nutrient, so calcium, potassium, magnesium, nitrogen, and phosphorus, associated to species, to genus, to family, to plot, or to residual, to something that we could not capture in our sampling. And what we see here roughly is that the proportion of unexplained variation varies between 60% and 70% for all nutrients, both in Brazil and Ghana. I should have put the flags here. But also that generally, the environmental factor, the plot factor, is larger in Ghana than in Brazil, except for phosphorus. You have a strong phosphorus signal for Brazil. And the more taxonomically related, the proportion of variation that comes for a species, genera, or family within any nutrient varies between the countries. So, for instance, take magnesium, and you don't have you have that part of the signal comes from a species and from family, but in Ghana you would have a large proportion that comes from the genera. So it's associated with the genera label taxonomically. And there is a bunch of studies that this is still working on, going on. This is work in progress, and specifically, I just wanted to mention quickly that we have two PhD students, Teresa and Halina, that are doing the seasonal ecophysiology, one in Ghana and one in Brazil. And I just wanted to plot that here is turgor loss point of the leaves in Brazil. We don't see any differences so far. And this we are doing lift water hydraulic potentials at different times of the day to see how it varies the lift water potential through the day and see regard things of hydraulic properties and hydraulic strategies of the species. And we are also analyzing, so doing some studies, trying to combine the role of drought and fire. So as you know, we had a very strong El Niño signal in Brazil, and many parts had a storm drought, and this is, for instance, dead proteas from in Brazil. This picture was taken in November because of drought. And then you had, in a number of places, fires that came after the drought and burned part of the vegetation. So there is a master's student from Brazil, Patrick, here, that is analyzing the recuperation of this vegetation in the Amazon, in Santarém, and Marina is doing the same in the savanna in Mato Grosso. And very quickly, because I think I'm over time. Do I have time, Kizinda? Yeah? It's just to show you now a little bit of the dynamic just in one place, just Ghana, forget Brazil. I'm just going to explain you a little bit of what we have been looking at in Ghana. A couple of years ago, Thomas Jansen, a master's student in Wageningen, did a remote sensing study and he analyzed the vegetation cover change through time series analysis. And what he found is that, well, that you would have some vegetation signals so here you would have the state of forest and savanna in 84, and here is the change in NDVI from 84 to 1990, the change in NDVI from 1990 to 2002, and the change in NDVI from 2002 in 2015. And here, what I want you to call your attention is a massive, so in red you would have decrease in NDVI, so loss in vegetation, just to say, and in green, increase in NDVI. This is the paper, it's in review in a remote sensing journal. So you have a massive decrease of NDVI between 1990 and 2002. And this is followed by a relative increase in the recovery of vegetation between 2002 and 2015. Even though we are observing he attributes it in the paper to body encroachment, so an increase in the body vegetation, even though that we have higher fire return intervals up to 1 year in the area. Mostly the fire is set, especially in this region, in the northern region of Kojai, every year by poachers. And we even know when they are going to set fire, so we have some fire experiments and some experiments going on there. So what we did also, we wanted to see, look at this wood encroachment. So if there is wood encroachment, there must be some seedling establishments. So a few years ago, with Annabelle, when was doing her master, we did a seedling plantation experiment in Kojai. So we took a bunch of seedlings of five different species. We planted them, we germinated them for a number of months. We went them and planted in field, and we left them there, and they went through a drought, and then after 8 months after being planted and having gone for a drought, they were burnt, and then we monitored its survival. And very quick, and we measured the number of leaf area, plot measures, and then seedling measures of height, mm-hmm. number of leaves, so biomass, resource allocation, and also starch in the stems, in the roots, and in the leaves. And what they found is that here you can see the mean accumulative water deficit, so the drought, this is when the seedlings were planted, so about 3 months after the seedling, we had the drought, and then rain came, and this bar indicates when the fire happened. And here you can see the burnt and unburned plots, we had an unburned control plots, and the mortality. So you can see that there was a massive mortality due to the dry season, but also then the onboard, of course, caused higher mortality. And here you can see that the seedling survival, this is a different type. So we planted this, sorry, I didn't mention that. We planted these seedlings in savanna, in forest, and in transitional vegetation. And we found that there were significant differences between where the seedlings have been planted. And this response also was going to the species level. So different species behave differently. So easy. So what we found then to decipher that is that the different strategies of the species would be allocated to different strategies of traits. And basically here, let me see if I remember, you would have the forest species that invested more in biomass, so you would have more SLA, root length ratio, root to shade radius. The transitional would be more in growth rate, and the savanna ones would be more in storage resources. So to answer the questions that I see, how and why do seedlings survive at the forest savanna transitions? So far, we have found different strategies, and it looks that it's easier in the savanna. So that was maybe one of the factors also that enhances food encroachment. Savanna, you have more light conditions, so it's easier to establish. What are the patterns of heat stridence? As you see, I haven't talked about that, so we don't know, but we are on it, and with especially with Halina and Teresa looking at the ecophysiology, and so we'll have someday some results. And what are the functional trait differences? We found that there are no marked differences in photosynthetic activity, but there are differences in leaf nutrient contents, and the source of variation seems to be more phylogenetically that environmentally related than site. Although site, of course, as we saw, also has an influence. And how are these relationships? Well, I think that these transitions are characterized by many shades of greens, and they can share some common axes, but the difference in terms of functional traits and structure driven by differences in the families and the species composition, and also to less extent to the environment they live in. And well, this is it. Thank you especially to the Ecosystems Lab and my colleagues that make my everyday life very funny and enjoyable, and all the amazing people that do this work in the field work. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.